the sense of the waves that stretched in all directions, the swollen bellies of clouds about to unleash rain, the sway of the boat as it charged through the water. It almost looked like it had the last time she was on the ocean, but she wasn't going to think about that now. Then the sea went flat as a pond, the boat stilling. She saw something dark moving just beneath the surface. It pierced the calm and shot up straight into the air. Another followed, and then another, too fast for Sloane to identify the objects, which were each as big as a man, no bigger. The perspective was just flattened by the camera angle. Whatever the things were hovered in midair over the water, which began to move again, the boat bobbing along like a rubber duck in a bathtub. The camera zoomed in on the objects, and Sloane realized they were trees. Not just trees, but pine trees. Dark needles heavy with water. There were maybe 30, all hanging at different heights, like wind chimes. "What?" Inez said. "The fuck?" "That's what I said," Henderson replied. "Would you open the second one, Cho?" Cho closed the first and clicked on the second, labeled 2ICI45G. "Australia," Cho said to introduce this one. The footage opened on a rocky beach, with the sun just beginning to set over the water. The land around it, even the dry grasses that grew on the slopes, glowed orange. "Are you sure?" a male voice asked from behind the camera. "Yeah," came the chirped reply. The camera swung to the side, showing a massive boulder as tall as a house, with others leaned up against it, as if part of the slope had crumbled off at some point in history, and the rubble had been left there. There were silhouettes of lithe bodies on boulders, beer bottles balanced next to them. Sloane spotted the ties of bikinis, the frayed hems of jean shorts, the brim of a baseball cap. The camera zoomed in on a girl, no older than 16, with a red and white striped bikini top and a flat, tanned stomach. She wore her sun-streaked hair loose around her shoulders. She had turned toward the camera and was waving. "If it doesn't work this time, I'll just fall in the water," she said with a shrug. "You recording?" "Yep," the man with the camera replied. "Go on." "Okay, watch." The sun burned orange behind the girl as she lifted one foot, skinny arms held out from her sides, and stepped into the air next to the boulder over the water. She then lifted up her other foot so she stood on nothing at all. Sloane could see the light of the sky beneath her heel. There was only emptiness beneath her, yet she wasn't falling. Half a dozen voices crowed with amazement. Fists in the air, bottles clinking together. The camera shuddering as the one who held it gave a shout. "I'm gonna take another step," the girl called out. And before anyone could object, she did, leaning out, seemingly into the sky. Her body tipped, not forward, but sideways. Her feet ripped from beneath her. She screamed as her hair dropped toward the water in a sun-bleached curtain. She fell, but not toward the ocean. She fell up, toward the clouds, her arms flailing, her screeches echoing over the rocks. The camera followed her as she grew smaller and smaller, a tiny black shape against the clouds. And then she was gone. And the man with the camera was screaming, "Barbara! Barbara!" The footage ended, leaving the screen blue again. They were all silent this time. "The third, please, Cho," Henderson said. The file was 3ICI45G. And the footage had been filmed underwater. It was blue, cloudy, and dreamlike. The surface undulating with light. Sloane thought again about the dive. Her her last trip to the ocean. The smell of salt and seaweed on the air. And she felt the tingling again. Not just in her fingertips this time, but all the way up to her elbows, as if her arms were asleep. She shook them out, watching as a diver entered the camera's line of sight, eyes shielded by the reflective mask. The figure jabbed a finger down and the camera swung in that direction. Sloane saw what she thought was a bunch of seaweed growing along the ocean floor. The person holding the camera swam closer, the movement smooth. Shafts of light shone through the surface, refracted by the waves, onto neat rows of plants, their long, sharp leaves shifting as the water did. The diver swam closer, and Sloane saw a large metal structure on wheels with a bar arching gently away. She recognized it. It was an irrigation pivot, like the kind used to water the fields around her hometown. Sloane leaned closer to the windows as she realized the neat rows of plants along the ocean floor were not seaweed, but stalks of corn. The shadow of a tractor loomed in the distance. The diver swam over the corn, zooming in on the intact husks among the leaves, then under the metal arch of the irrigation system, where the tractor was in full view, as was the man still sitting atop it, trapped there with his knees under the steering wheel, his arms floating toward the surface. Cho stopped the footage so that image stayed frozen on the screen for a few seconds before she closed it. "That was in Hawaii 3 weeks ago," she said. "We haven't been able to identify the man, but the girl from the second clip, Barbara DeVore, she's been missing for a month now." "It has to be magic," Matt said. "Right? There's nothing else it could be." "It certainly falls under the category of the supernormal," Henderson said. "We have done extensive investigations on each one of these incidents, as well as hundreds of others that have occurred over the past decade. We've been able to confirm that these are not hoaxes." "There are always supernormal occurrences here and there," Cho said. "But they seem to be happening closer and closer together, and they're becoming more numerous." "Do you?" Albie swallowed so hard Sloane could see his Adam's apple forcing its way down. "Do you think the Dark One is back or something? Is that why you asked us to come here?" Sloane felt a burning in her chest, and she wasn't sure if it was the same thing causing the tingling in her arms, or if it was just run-of-the-mill terror. She couldn't sit still anymore. She got up, stepped around her chair. "What is it?" Cho said. "Can a gal do a good old-fashioned pace back and forth without getting questioned?" Sloane replied. Henderson chuckled a little and said, "No, we don't think it's the Dark One. We haven't seen any evidence of his return. There are no actors present at any of these incidents, see? No one wielding magic. But magic is happening anyway. It seems to us, well, the prevailing theory in Eris anyway, is that it's like a malfunctioning radio. It's creepy when it starts playing music out of nowhere, but it doesn't mean anything sinister."
"You're saying that our planet is like a malfunctioning radio?" Matt said.
"And that doesn't alarm you?"
"Obviously it alarms us," Cho said. "But I'll take the source of Earth's magic being busted, or whatever this is, over the Dark One any day." Sloane was moving, now without meaning to, toward the double doors across the room. Her body was burning, and as she drew closer, she smelled something sulfurous and chemical and familiar. Her hands had smelled that way after she did magic with the artifact. The Needle of Koshe. She hadn't known when she went with a crew of Eris agents to the middle of the Pacific Ocean how much the needle would cost her. In the end, she had been so desperate to get rid of it that she had chewed it out of her own hand. The others had gone quiet. Or maybe she just couldn't hear them over the pulse in her ears. She didn't try the handles of the doors, just pressed both palms against them
and drew a long, slow breath. She felt Matt standing behind her. She didn't need to look to know it was him. She knew the shape of him, the heat of him, how close he dared to stand, so their arms were almost touching. And not because they were dating. No, engaged, she reminded herself. But because that's how Matt was. Not afraid to get close to anyone. "What is it?" he asked. "You don't feel it," she said. "It feels weird in here, but no more than usual for a drain site," Matt said. "Why? What do you feel?" Sloane stared at the scar on the back of her right hand, a web of thick tissue paler than the rest of her skin. "It's been bothering me since we got here." "They made something new," she said. "And it's through these doors, somewhere." "Okay," Matt said, touching her shoulder. "Okay, let's go sit down and ask them about it." Sloane nodded. On some level, she recognized that she would feel embarrassed later. But for now, she just let Matt take her hand and lead her back to the table. Henderson, Cho, Albie, and Inez were still sitting there, looking confused.
"Well, I guess that's as good a segue as any,"
Henderson said, scratching at his beard.
"These incidents have been increasing in frequency. We've stepped up certain programs we were already working on. It seems important to understand what exactly magic is and how to use it. So we've developed a device that we believe channels magic. You reacting to it that way, Sloane, is actually really encouraging."
"You haven't tested it?" Inez said.
"Not yet," Cho said. "We were hoping you might agree to help us. You are, after all, the only people we are aware of who have successfully wielded magic before. You're less likely to cause a catastrophe."
Sloane tasted copper. She wished she had that empty potato chip bag with her.
"Did you go for a wand?" Inez said. "Or, like, an orb? Or is it a giant hammer? Please say it's a giant hammer."
"No," Sloane said.
"Yeah, you're right. It's the government, so it's probably a boring box," Inez said.
"No," Sloane said.
"No, we aren't going to help you test your fucking weapon."
"Slow," Matt said. "Just because it uses magic doesn't mean it's a weapon."
Cho sat down in the chair across from Sloane and folded her hands on the table. Her fingers were thick at the knuckle and calloused. Sloane had heard her say once that she liked rock climbing.
"In order to know how to fix whatever it is that's broken," Cho said, "we need to understand how magic works and how it's used. So we have made a tool, that's all."
"You expect me to believe you developed this thing so you could keep teenage girls from falling into the sky?" Sloane scowled. "You were already making it before you realized something was wrong. You just said that."
"We are a branch of the government concerned with scientific advancement," Cho began.
"I studied history," Sloane interrupted, swallowing down the flavor of blood in her mouth. "And I know what motivates the government to invest in scientific advancement. We only have rockets that go into space because you guys were trying to blow up Soviets. This is just another space race."
"Even if it is a weapon," Henderson said, "would you rather Russia or China figure it out first, Sloane? And do you think they won't be racing to harness magic themselves?"
"I would rather governments stopped playing the who can destroy each other faster game," Sloane snapped.
She knew by the ringing in her ears that she was panicking.
"Yeah, well, I'd rather open up a goddamn ice cream shop," Henderson said, "but we all have to deal with reality."
"Countless people have died because of magic," Matt said. "Right here, in this spot, actually. It's happened right in front of us. And you want us to be complicit in something that might bring more of that?" He sounded choked. Sloane hadn't heard him sound that way in a long time. After what we've seen? After what we've done?
He didn't know the half of it, Sloane thought. He didn't know a damn thing about what she had done. And it would stay that way.
Beside her, Albie was staring at his hands, curled over the edge of the table. His fingers had once been nimble enough to fold the most intricate origami Sloane had ever seen. He had tried to teach her once how to make a crane, and the session had ended in a heap of crumpled paper. But the damage sustained from their time as captives of the Dark One had taken the feeling from his fingertips. So he had given up the hobby. Now those hands were trembling.
"Albie," she said.
He didn't look at her.
"Isn't it?"
He cleared his throat. Albie was shorter than average, with thinning blonde hair that stuck up in all the wrong places, and a hunched posture from the permanent damage done to his spine. He was nobody's chosen one. Not now, and not ever.
"Isn't it important to know how to use it, though?" he said.
"So it can't be used against us again."
"Albie," Matt said, "you can't mean that."
"Don't give me that hero voice," Albie said, his own voice shaking. "Nobody ever used magic against you. Any of you. The way the Dark One used it against me. Whether it's a tool or a weapon or a freaking plush toy. I'm not going to sit back and let the rest of the world figure out how to do it to us without us knowing how to do it back. Mutually assured destruction." Sloane reached for words and came up empty. He had a point. She had been kidnapped by the Dark One too, but he hadn't done to her what he had done to Albie. Hadn't attacked her body and left her with no feeling in her hands and no way to rejoin the fight. He had done something else. Damaged her without so much as touching her.
"If people die because of your help," she said finally, her throat aching, "you'll have to carry that around."
"And if people die because I don't help," he said, meeting her eyes at last, "either way, we'll carry it. We always do."
Top Secret. Agency for the Research and Investigation of the Supernormal. Memorandum 4. Robert Robertson, Officer. Agency for the Research and Investigation of the Supernormal. Eris. Subject: Project Ringer. Subject 2. Deep Dive Aftermath.
"Dear Officer Robertson, attached is the document we discussed. Sloane and I developed this piece of writing in one of our sessions as part of her ongoing cognitive behavioral therapy for PTSD. In our exposure therapy practice, we need to reliably provoke Sloane's panic so that she can become habituated to the emotions it brings forth. As such, the following exposure is as detailed as Sloane could manage in order to most effectively stimulate a re-experiencing of the event, which we refer to as the dive. I must remind you to keep this confidential, as providing this to you is a violation of HIPAA. However, given how dire the situation is, I agree that an exception must be made. Thank you and have a pleasant week. Sincerely, Dr. Maureen Thomas."
I'm on the Eris ship. It's a cold morning. I see the glare of the sun on the water. As I pull the string attached to the zipper of my wetsuit, the fabric tugs in from both sides toward my spine. The mouthpiece tastes like chemicals. My nose feels blocked as I try to breathe only through my mouth. All around me are Eris officers, at first identical in their black scuba gear. But if I look closely, I see the swell of Maggie's hips, or Marie's long, muscular legs, or the bristle of Dan's mustache. Their eyes are shielded by the goggles, which is a relief. since they've been looking at me skeptically since I met them. And they have good reasons. I'm only 15. I got my dive certification in a hurry once Bert briefed me on the mission. I've only practiced a few times. But I'm chosen, and that means they have to follow my lead. So even though I'm shivering in the cold and squinting into the sun, and so scared I want to throw up right into the ocean, I sit on the edge of the boat and slide into the water. There's a rush of cold. I try to stay still, to breathe deep into the regulator, to exhale fully before inhaling so I don't hyperventilate. All over me is something tingling and burning. It's not the sting of salt water on the skin around my eyes. It's more like feeling coming back to a limb that's gone to sleep. On the way here, I asked the Aeris officers if they felt it too. They didn't. They don't. Just me. Is she making it up? I feel them wondering. And I'm wondering too. The others are in the water now. Someone tosses me the line that will keep me attached to the boat, and I hook it to my belt, tug at it to make sure it's secure. All the Aeris officers wait for me to move. They look like aliens in their mirrored masks, polarized so they can see better underwater. The dive is too deep for a beginner like me, but there's nothing anyone can do about it. I have to go. I think of that Millet poem as I kick my flippers. Down, down, down into the darkness of the grave. I have a flashlight in one hand, held against my side. I swim away from the boat, checking over my shoulder now, and then to make sure the others are following me. What's ahead of me is just cloudy blue. Bubbles and particles of sand. The occasional piece of seaweed flopping past. A darker shape develops slowly in front of me, and I know what it is. I wasn't expecting the boat to blend so well into the bottom of the ocean. It's coated in a fine layer of sand, the same muted blue as the ocean floor. It could have been a stretch of dead coral if not for the sharp bends of the radar aerials and the main mast, with its attached ladder, the rungs still white when I shine my flashlight on them. I know this ship, the Sakhalin. I researched it right after the briefing, months ago. A Soviet spy ship, Primorye class, built sometime between 1969 and 1971. The Primorye class ships had been converted from large fishing boats, outfitted to gather electronic intelligence and transmit it back to shore. They were not usually made for combat, but the Sakhalin was special. When I swim closer, I shift the beam of light back to the distinct bulges of weapon systems, one of them now wrapped in seaweed. The tingling is in my chest now, right behind my sternum, like heartburn. When I swim closer to the ship, it drops to my belly, right to the middle of me. I keep kicking, moving toward the energy. I have no choice. I don't mean that Aeris is forcing me. I mean that whatever it is, the feeling, even though it's almost painful, won't let me turn back. Someone tugs on the line attached to me, a signal that I should stop. I don't. I swim over the deck gun and dodge the bulk of the aft superstructure. As I pass over the smoke funnel, I feel a stab of terror, like I'm going to be sucked into the blackness and disassembled. But I can't stop swimming. I reach the aft mast, and I know I'm in the right place. The burning in my chest turns to a thump. Built in the base of the aft mast is a door fastened by a busted lock. Without thinking much about it, I slam the base of my flashlight into the lock, once, twice, three times. Already worn by time and exposure to water, the lock breaks. The little door opens, and I turn my beam of light toward it. Inside the mast, there's a small trunk about the size of a toaster, elaborately decorated with gilt and enamel, in a pattern of flowers and leaves that reminds me of babushkas and matryoshka dolls. I know I should swim with it to the surface. Let the Aeris officers scan it with their equipment to make sure it's safe. But if I do that, they'll form a perimeter around it, and I have to be looking at it, holding it, feeling inside me the pounding of its heart. So I open it. Settled inside on a bed of black velvet is a silver needle about the length of my palm. Koshe's needle. I read a lot of folk tales to prepare for this mission. They say Koshe was a man who couldn't die. He hid his soul away from his body in a needle and put the needle in an egg, the egg in a duck, the duck in a hare, and the hare in a trunk. Only when a person broke the needle could they take his life. I am trembling when I touch it. I think it trembles too. And then, horrible pain, a flash of white. The tingling of returned feeling is gone, and in its place I'm enveloped in flames. Scalding skin peeling away from muscle, muscle cooked away from bone, bone turning into ash. That's what it feels like. I scream into the regulator mask and it pulls away from my face, letting in water. I choke and thrash, struggling to grab the line that attaches me to the boat, but my hands won't work. And then it's like a pang so deep I feel it in every part of my body, like the sounding of a clock tower at midnight. It feels like wanting something so much you would die to get it. More than craving or longing or desire. I am empty. And more than that, a black hole. So absolutely composed of nothingness that I attract all somethingness to me. All around me, the water swirls and churns. Bubbles so thick they keep me from seeing anything. Pieces break off from the ship and enter the cyclone of water. Black shapes tumble past me. The Aeris officers in their scuba suits. I choke on water as I scream, and I feel like I'm pulling something in, like I'm drawing a breath. The next time I open my eyes, I'm staring at the sky. All across it are clouds. I tip forward, water rushing down my back and into the wetsuit. The water that surrounds me isn't blue. It's red. Dark red. My hand hurts so badly I can't stand it. I lift it up to look at it. Something hard and straight is buried under my skin like a splinter, right next to one of my tendons. I press against it. It's Koshe's needle. Something bobs to the surface next to me. It looks like a piece of plastic at first. But when I pick it up, it's soft and slippery. I scream, dropping it when I realize it's skin. All around me are pieces of skin and muscle and bone and viscera. Everyone is dead, and I'm alone. Chapter 9. They left Albie with Cho so he could try the device. She had promised to get him home when they were finished. Sloane had no doubt that the device worked. She would not have felt its presence so strongly if it didn't. They all had their own way of relating to magic, and hers was with craving and seeking and understanding. She knew the device. And the device knew her. Albie had been more straightforward in his use of magic. Albie with the Freikugeln, the bullets of German legend that struck their targets without fail, had just been a man with a tool, the same as a hammer or a saw. His artifact had not burrowed under his skin, becoming part of him, the way Koshe's needle had done to her. He had simply held the bullets. And though they never did what the legend said they would, none of the artifacts they had collected had. They had allowed him to perform rudimentary magic, lighting fires, making objects float, things like that. Inez, Matt, and Sloane walked back down the spoke of the bicycle wheel and around its circumference until they reached Scott in his golf cart. She didn't feel fear of the device anymore. Instead, what she felt was numbness, a separation between body and mind. She knew that time would weld the two together again. She would just have to wait. Scott took them out the same way they had come in, weaving a serpentine path through the tents. Hardly a minute into the drive, Sloane spotted the tent with, "Make things right, bring him back," on it. And the ringing in her ears intensified. The distance between mind and body that she had maintained since sensing the magical device collapsed suddenly, like hands clapping together. She braced herself on the handrail that was keeping her in her seat and threw herself out of the golf cart to the tune of Inez and Matt crying Sloane in unison. She walked past a little altar made of a stump with what looked like a squirrel skeleton wrapped in beads and twine perched atop it, and a tent with a dream catcher hanging in the zipped shut doorway, likely mass-produced in China and distributed in the home section of a hipster clothing chain. These people wanted magic, but they had no idea what magic really was. They had never seen the great unraveling of the drain, the way it had separated all living things into distinct pieces. Bone, sinew, blood, and nerve flung apart so you could see the fine details that made up a body, all while said body was still conscious enough to comprehend it. When she reached the little campfire of boys pretending to be men, they had finished cooking their hot dogs and were now listening to music, but Sloane could only hear the thump of the bass. The ringing in her ears was too strong at that point for her to hear much of anything, including Inez calling out her name behind her. She noted the hunting knife on top of a pallet of bottled water nearby and planted her feet in front of the portable grill, staring down at the man who had almost, but not quite, called her bitch earlier. It was not the first time she had been called that word, and it wouldn't be the last. But there was a certain violence in it, the way it made her anger small and petty, the way it reduced her entire self to some narrow, foolish thing. "Hello there," she said, her voice sounding oddly unctuous all of a sudden. "Do you recognize me?" She could tell by his wide eyes that he did. And just as they were narrowing, just as the word bitch was likely taking shape in his mouth again, she bent and picked up the hunting knife. "What?" the man started, but she had already unsheathed the hunting knife and plunged it into the side of the tent, right through the right in Make Things Right. "What the fuck?" the man shouted. They were all on their feet. Sloane only heard ringing. "You idiot," she said. "You think he would welcome your loyalty if he came back? That he would reward you? If he comes back to life, he will rip your guts out just like everyone else's." "He only targeted the weak," the man said. "Your boy over there got lucky the first time." His eyes shifted over Sloane's shoulder to the golf cart, to Inez and Matt. But she didn't hear what he said next. She just punched him in the face. The ringing in her ears stopped. Pain crackled in every knuckle. She shook out her hand, gritting her teeth against the ache that spread all the way up her arm. The man's nose was bleeding, and his friends were on their feet around him, shouting obscenities at her, but not quite ready to fight back. She was still a girl, after all. She had thrown punches before, but she always forgot how badly it hurt. Inez grabbed her arm and dragged her away.
She yelled "eat shit" over her shoulder before getting back in the golf cart. Scott was staring at her when she sat down. "What?" she said. And he just shook his head and drove on, going as fast as the little cart could carry them.
Top secret. Memorandum for the record. 2. Director. Agency for the Research and Investigation of the Supranormal, ERIS. From Officer. Codename Bert. Subject: Deep Dive Aftermath.
Dear Director, I very much appreciated your letter regarding the deep dive incident. We are deeply saddened by the loss of some of our finest agents, and it has been difficult to carry on with Project Ringer without them. But as you noted in your message, we must soldier on for the sake of the cause. The Dark One is too potent a threat. I understand your concern about Sloane Andrews's ability to move forward after such a trauma. I am writing only to give you my observations. The decision is, of course, up to you. I have thought it over carefully, and I must recommend against releasing Sloane Andrews from Project Ringer for the following reasons. 1. Despite costing the lives of multiple agents, whose value cannot be estimated, and upward of $1 million, money we can't recoup, obviously, Project Deep Dive was technically a success. We were able to retrieve Koshe's needle, which is currently buried in Sloane Andrews' hand. Which brings me to my next point. 2. Though we have discussed the possibility of removing the needle surgically, everyone here at Project Ringer is reluctant to interfere with a force we don't fully understand. We don't know how the needle will behave if it is disturbed. Therefore, we can regard Sloane and the needle as inextricably linked. To dismiss Sloane Andrews now would be a tremendous waste of resources, as well as a waste of the lives lost retrieving the needle. 3. Though Sloane herself has asked to be relieved of duty, I don't think it will be difficult to get her cooperation. I have been observing her for years now. She trusts me. She has come to regard me as something of a paternal figure. If I tell her to stay, she will stay. 4. The behavior of Koshe's needle suggests that Sloane has a strong affinity for magic. Though the events of the deep dive were tragic, they were also indicative of tremendous power, which we may need to defeat the Dark One. I suggest, therefore, that we encourage Sloane to employ the same techniques that soldiers, often unconsciously, use in active combat, compartmentalizing trauma so that they can continue in battle and suppressing those parts of their personalities that do not serve them in intense situations. Sloane Andrews functions well alone and with a high degree of personal responsibility and autonomy. I will foster her independent streak by assigning her solo missions while I form the others into a functioning team under the leadership of Matthew Weeks. We can instruct Sloane's psychotherapist, Dr. Maureen Thomas, to combine drug therapy with compartmentalization techniques so that Sloane is able to maintain a reasonable level of stability in the short term. Let me know if you'd like to discuss this plan or offer any suggestions. Thank you again for your concern and for the flowers. We can but endeavor to move forward. Sincerely.
Top secret. Memorandum for the record. 2. Director. Agency for the Research and Investigation of the Supranormal, ERIS. From Officer. Codename Bert. Subject: Regarding Deep Dive Aftermath.
Dear Director, in my previous letter, I offered my observations about Sloane Andrews in the aftermath of the deep dive incident and presented to you a plan of action. In response, you expressed frustration with my psychobabble mumbo-jumbo and told me to speak plain English. While I would appreciate a more amicable tone moving forward, I understand the necessity of simple language in matters such as these. So I will try to put this in terms you can understand. I previously observed about Sloane Andrews that she was a bit like a stray dog. Feed a starved dog, and you will have its loyalty, even if you don't treat it well. For Sloane, her need for approval will be the leash I keep her on, even while she feels like she's roaming around free. We can't lose our Project Ringer subjects. It's too late for that now. Either they defeat the Dark One for us, or we all die. I hope that this English is plain enough for you, sir. Sincerely.
Chapter 10. Sloane was at the entrance to the modern wing of the Art Institute of Chicago at 9:30 a.m. Time for her friend Rebecca to let her in, though the museum didn't open to the public for another hour. She saw Rebecca through the glass doors, tying off the end of her braid. Rebecca yawned, unlocked the door, and waved Sloane in.
"You're too prompt," Rebecca said. "Why aren't you hungover like everyone else our age?" "First of all," Sloane said, "our age is not a thing because you are 22. And second of all, it's Tuesday."
"So?" Rebecca said. "Monday night booze tastes just as good as Saturday night booze."
Sloane's presence in the art museum at odd hours had become commonplace. The staff knew her, and no one had ever objected to someone letting her in early. It was, possibly, the only perk of being a chosen one that she actually enjoyed. This was part of her weekday rhythm. She didn't have a job. The government had paid them for their years of service, and Sloane had handed the money over to an investment bank. The interest would keep her going for a while, provided she spent carefully. The others had found more financial stability, but at a cost. Matt had sold the rights to his autobiography and partnered with an experienced writer, and that money was plenty to coast on. Not that he did. He was always traveling, speaking at conferences and universities, appearing at charity balls and philanthropic galas, meeting with politicians and community organizers. Esther, too, had turned her fame into money, cultivating her Insta following as she would a garden. Inez had illustrated her own graphic novel about her story, rendering the Dark One's death in swirls of color. Albie, meanwhile, was in some commercials abroad, using his face to make back the money he had lost by going to rehab. One day, Sloane would have to find a job for which her identity wouldn't be an issue. One that required no qualifications or experience, or she would have to sell off pieces of herself one by one, the way everyone else had. She didn't blame them for it. Not much, anyway. But part of her felt like she would sooner live in her mother's garage than sacrifice what little privacy she had carved out of her own fame. The modern wing was bright and open, a wide corridor of white with galleries on either side. She climbed the stairs to the third floor, which was where she always began the visitation, in the architecture and design gallery. The space was empty, of course. It usually was, regardless of how packed the rest of the museum was. She wandered past the chairs made of twisted wire and the vase that looked like spilled milk to the sketches of proposed Chicago buildings. Then she sat on a nearby bench and stared at the drawing from the Burnham plan, the proposed city design for Chicago that had never come to fruition. Her brother, Cameron, had been studying architecture when he answered the call to fight the Dark One. He had died in one of the drains in Minneapolis. They had fought over his decision to put school on hold, even though she had been young at the time, only 12. "You're not a soldier," she had told him. "You're a skinny nerd and you'll get yourself killed." A rare moment of prescience, maybe. She had taken all of Cameron's things from her mother's house and pored over the sketches in his journals so many times she had them all memorized. Everything from a child's drawing of a doghouse to a detailed, carefully measured floor plan of his dream home. He had wanted to make places that felt interesting and warm. Places that didn't feel like home, she had joked with him once. At least not like their home. He had liked it here,
So now Sloane came here. Not to the drain site where he had lost his life. Not to their central Illinois haunts, but here, to visit him. She rarely stayed long. A half hour, maybe. And then she would drift through the other exhibits. The new one downstairs was a series of photographs of big rig trucks. After wandering through them for a few minutes, she said goodbye to Rebecca, who already looked bored out of her mind, and left. She turned right, walked to the lakefront path, and did a few stretches before jogging north, toward Inez and Albie's place. The lake reflected steel blue back at her. It was a cloudy day, and there was a mist over the water, blurring the horizon line. The run was about 6.5 miles and would take her an hour if she kept up her usual pace. She passed a small fleet of spandex people on bicycles and a woman in hot pink leggings walking a spotted hound. A man in short shorts breezed past her. She watched the crashing of the waves against the breakers, the dogs chasing tennis balls on the dog beach, the speed-walking women in visors with their fists pumping at their sides. No one paid any attention to her. Not here, where she was just another jogger. She turned away from the lakefront path and toward Java Jam. She ordered the coffees breathlessly, then carried them down the street to Inez and Albie's apartment, a second-floor corner unit in a grand two-flat. The stairwell carpeting was dark green and worn down the middle, where too many shoes had trodden. The walls were covered with wallpaper that had tiny flowers on it in purple and red and blue. Inez was already at the door when Sloane reached the landing, her glasses on and her hair piled on top of her head. "Little early, aren't you?" she said, grabbing her coffee from the tray and turning away from the door. Sloane followed her in, sipping the coffee that was left. She got a mouthful of cinnamon. "Switch." They traded cups. "Don't know how you drink that, it's pure milk." Sloane's sneakers squeaked on the floor, which was the standard Chicago yellowish oak that creaked no matter where you stepped. Albie's door was closed, and so was Inez's, but in different ways. Albie's was closed like he just wanted to keep the noise of the hallway out. Inez's was locked and bolted from the outside, as secure as a bank vault. Up until a few years ago, she had been booby-trapping it, even though it was illegal. And Sloane didn't have the heart to ask if she was still doing that. She pretended to be fine. But Sloane had seen the neat row of medications on her dresser, the twitch of her body at certain sounds and gestures. The apartment was warm and comfortable, with a colossal beanbag chair that was always leaking pellets. The curtains on the two windows facing the alley that were just a Canadian and a Mexican flag, respectively. Inez went back to the stove, poking at her eggs with a wooden spoon. The whole room smelled like onions. "You know, once you hit 30, this whole living like a college junior thing is going to be less charming and more creepy," Sloane said. "What do you mean, like a college junior? Are you referring to Frodo?" "You mean the giant beanbag you decided to name Frodo Baggins? Yes, that's exactly what I'm referring to." "Just because you refuse to enjoy your life doesn't mean the rest of us can't," Inez said. "You have white bathroom towels and you're invigorated by early morning runs in the sleet. You're like the dad from Calvin and Hobbes."
"I always liked Calvin's dad."
"Of course you did," Inez snorted. "Have you talked to Matt yet?" Sloane shook her head. "He had the mass incarceration thing last night and a meeting this morning. Why?" Inez sipped her coffee. "I'm in trouble, aren't I?" Sloane said. Inez shrugged. "If he thinks I'm going to apologize for punching that asshole..."
"I'm not here to have your fight with Matt before you have it," Inez said.
"Just don't assume he's going to thank you for being his little white knight."
Sloane scowled at her.
"Yeah, I said it," Inez said. "Did you see the SE Says update?"
"No, how bad is it?"
Inez took her phone out of the pocket of her sweatshirt and handed it to Sloane. Esther's Insta account was already on the screen. Sloane recognized the familiar setting of one of Esther's videos,
her office, which was decorated like someone's Pinterest dream. Draped in stylish fabrics with muted colors, a string of pale pink fairy lights, and an expensive camera that captured all the shine in her hair and every knickknack on her shelves. And in the middle of it all, Esther, dressed in a heather gray sweater that bunched up at her wrists as she drank from a teacup with a little bird carved into the side. The video was titled, "Essie Says Is Going Places." As Sloane watched, Esther introduced a clip from the day before, showing her skincare and makeup in fast forward as she got ready. Sloane was always perversely fascinated by how many steps Esther's skincare routine had. Sloane could never have remembered that many things in the morning. Not without coffee. And maybe amphetamines. "I'm not watching her put on makeup. It'll give me hives," Sloane said. But Inez was already reaching over the island. She skipped forward on the video, past the impressive powdering and lining and staining, until there was Esther back in her gray sweater again, sipping from her teacup.
"I have some news to share," Esther said with a waggle of her eyebrows.
She was talking in her video voice, chipper and unctuous, similar to her speaking voice, but more.
"No, I'm not talking about the big punch from my girl Sloane. The link to that is in the caption."
Sloane sighed. "Ugh, fantastic."
"February 13th, I'll be launching Essie, my very own lifestyle brand."
Esther's perfectly lined eyes sparkled.
"That's right. You'll now have a one-stop shop for all the product recommendations and reviews you could ever ask for. And you know you want to be an Essie girl."
"Well," Sloane said as Inez stopped the video. "That was inevitable, I guess." Inez turned off the stove and tipped the eggs onto a plate that waited on the counter.
"I invited her to come down with me in a couple weeks. You should come too. Get away from the cold."
"I love the cold," Sloane said. "It's my Nordic blood."
"No, it's your determination to love what everyone else hates and hate what everyone else loves," Inez said.
She jabbed the rubbery eggs with the tines of her fork.
"You should still come. I'm going to kidnap Albie."
Sloane winced at the word kidnap.
"Have you seen him since?" Sloane said.
"Did he tell you if the prototype worked or anything?"
Inez's brow furrowed.
"No.
He came home last night and disappeared into his room right away.
But it worked. It must have."
Sloane felt the irrepressible need to sleep suddenly.
"Maybe it's not so bad," Inez said, shrugging a little.
"If the world is breaking, that girl floating toward the sky, my God, maybe we'll need magic to fix it."
"If anything, magic is what broke it," Sloane said darkly.
"You hate it so much," Inez said, nodding to the knot of scars on Sloane's hand.
"But you've never explained why."
Sloane put her hand under the lip of the counter.
"I don't hate it exactly," she said.
"I've just seen what it can do."
"So have all of us."
"Yeah." But Sloane didn't mean the drains or the leveling of the tower or even the death of the Dark One. She meant the taste of copper and salt on her tongue as she had surfaced after the dive. Her coffee had run out, and only foam was left.
Chapter 11. That evening, Sloane got a text from Esther.
"Nice jab. Bert would be proud."
She included a link to a blurry cell phone video of Sloane punching the Dark One acolyte. The still image in the article was of Sloane with teeth bared, her fist up by her face. Sloane looked herself over. The sheen of sweat on her pale face. The weird hollowness to her eyes. It was an expression she had seen in the mirror often since the Dark One's death.
"Shit," she said aloud.
Matt had just gotten home from a coffee meeting with Eddie. He was hanging his coat up in the closet.
"There's a video of the punch online," she said.
"What a shock," Matt replied, closing the closet door. He had the sleeves of his powder blue shirt rolled up to his elbows.
I'm not sorry, you know, she said. That guy was a piece of shit. He deserved it. That's not the issue.
I was defending you, Sloane said.
Yeah, and that is the issue, Matt said.
I don't need you to defend me, Sloane. I can take care of myself.
But you weren't going to, Sloane said.
You're so passive about stuff like this.
Passive? Matt laughed harshly. Passive? What do you think I've been doing every day since the Dark One fell exactly? Twiddling my thumbs?
No, of course not, Sloane scowled, but guys like that are not my problem, Matt said.
They're easy to spot and easy to avoid. My real problem is contented people who smile while refusing to lift a finger for anyone who isn't them. That's who I spend every day fighting, trying to get them to fucking do something. And it would be really nice if my fiancé could understand that instead of making things harder for me.
How the hell do I do that? Sloane snapped. It's my picture that's in the news, not yours.
Yeah, it's your picture. But now those assholes and their message are in the news again, and they get to be the victims this time. You came at them out of nowhere, threatened them with a knife.
I didn't threaten anyone with a knife.
That's not what the picture of you holding a knife looks like.
Do you think that shit doesn't come back on the rest of us? That if you're violent to protect me and Inez, that doesn't make us look violent too? And we don't get to bounce back the way you do. We get to sit here worrying if a bunch of extremists are going to burn our houses down.
It's not going to happen.
Well, it must be nice to feel that confident, Matt said.
But I don't. I don't get to lose my shit and punch a guy. I don't get to mess up. I am always failing someone all the time.
All the anger seemed to go out of him at once. He sat down on the couch and slumped over his knees. The ice pack Sloane had been using for her swollen knuckles was wedged between the cushions, no longer frozen. She wanted to comfort him, but she didn't know how. She had never seen him so tired, so disappointed in the world, in himself, even in her. She sat next to him on the couch, her hands clasped over her knees. The television was off, so she saw them reflected in the black screen. Matt's head hanging low, Sloane stiff and upright.
He called you boy, she said quietly.
Yeah, Matt said, turning his head so their eyes met. What else is new?
What was I supposed to do, just let him talk down to you? She said.
I mean, for one thing, you were supposed to stay in the golf cart. He raised an eyebrow. What's going on with you lately? You charged at him like a bull even before he said anything. It's like you want to set the world on fire.
Esther had asked her that too. What's going on with you?
The answer, of course, was waiting in the bottom drawer of her desk, the stack of FOIA documents she had stashed there. Like he had read her mind, Matt said.
Esther told me about your FOIA request.
God, Esther.
Sloane pressed her hands to her face briefly. I'm never telling her anything ever again.
Matt waited. There was something about his posture that irritated her. The defeated sag to his shoulders. It would have been better if he had yelled at her.
I requested the Project Ringer documents, she said. I wanted to know everything I could. It's my life, and they have all these records of it.
I understand wanting to know, he said. I just think it's weird you didn't tell me, and that you mentioned it to Esther before me.
I was going to tell you right away, she said.
But then I read more, and it was upsetting.
And what, you didn't want to upset me?
She shook her head.
That's not it.
Tell me about it then.
He sounded earnest, but Sloane knew him too well to be fooled. He had used this tone when they fought the Dark One. She remembered one particular evening
They had been trying to track the Dark One when he was just a man, not a shadow in the middle of a drain. Inez had been following a promising lead that had yielded nothing. "Tell me what happened," Matt had said. But it had just been a moment of quiet before he erupted. The struggle had drawn them all as taut as an overstrung harp. She had not realized that the strain of living with her lately, or maybe of the 10 years peace celebrations, had affected him so much. "Sometimes," she said, taking her time, "when I'm upset about something, all you want to do is tell me why I shouldn't be.
And that's bad?
It makes me feel crazy, like I can't trust my own reactions to things."
"We all need people to help us see things from different perspectives,"